will be part of our test also.
Yes.
Of course.
What are you worried about?
Do we have to color it?
You have to color
it. You have to color it? No, but I do give extra credit. We are studying the myth, science as myth. Well, how do I title this? Mythology of science. My heart's always open. I explained what I meant by myth, and we see the function of myth. And it has led to the ethical requirements of the promised scientific utopia. And let me, the idea that of utopianism, let me discuss, let me add a comment on this utopianism, on the way that it affects the modern mind that we're dealing with. I cite one piece of evidence, this dedication of the dedication to scientists and the fervent passionate desire to find life on other planets. Another example is, this is not your syllabus, another example is where you see, and we're going to talk about this in this outline that I gave you, you see this way in which the mind of scientism, we might call it, the mind of scientism, simply refuses to face facts when facts contradict, or seem to contradict at least, the prevailing worldview. It's called bias and prejudice. And one is, have you ever, one is the, this is very amazing, the biblical view of man, which was not always theologically correct, but which was correct enough in that it saw man as fallen, as a sinner, as not to be trusted, who will destroy the social institutions, who will fight, who will start wars, was replaced by the Enlightenment view of man. Man, the goodness of man, whether that man is basically good. And despite the evidence that that view persists. And as an aspect of that view, communism is built on the Enlightenment view of man. Important. Communism is based on the Enlightenment, the French, the 18th century French Enlightenment, 18th and 17th century views of man. That is, the goodness of man. So that man will, that is, that man, if you do away with private property, private ownership, then you'll do away with greed. And you'll do away with all kinds of things. So that, and eventually the state will wither. That is, man, you can disband your armies and fire your police, and the state will wither. And man, once you remove these negative things that capitalism has put into culture, then man, the goodness of man will emerge, will surface, and you'll have a classless society, eventually becomes the stateless society. Well, it hasn't happened. It isn't coming close to happening. But that does not change the basic conviction of the modern secularist that that's still true. I mean, let me give you two examples of it. First of all, it's just a prevailing myth. I mean, it's just an absolute myth that everybody believes that the evidence utterly contradicts and that it's going to be believed no matter what, and that is that poverty is the reason for crime. You understand? Why is there crime? Because there's poverty. Despite the fact that the vast majority of crime of robbery, this type of ratio is carried out by people who drive cattle, you know, who are not poor. You know. It's true you get a little bit of crime from poor people. But the underworld is not poor, is it? The biggest thieves in the world are big business. The number one thieves in America are the bankers. They steal more money than the was given. They're not poor. Now they steal from taxpayers. That is, this foreign debt, the Central and South American debt. They loan money when Americans could not borrow homes, could not borrow money to build homes. They were loaning it to Saudi Arabia and to Brazil because they could get more interest. And when these countries defaulted, who paid? Taxpayers. This is called stealing.
Legally,
sorry, they were still stealing. And look at the drug traffickers. These poor people that catch them just trying to eat. when they landed their Learjet and the suitcases with $16 million in it. Poor people are just trying to get by the next meal. You get my point? It's simply not true. You go to university or taught, and this is just a sin. We get rid of poverty, we get rid of crime. That's why we have crime. The poverty. Another more sinister example of this blind mindset, this has been created by this enlightenment view of man, is the idea is that you notice that the media, the liberal media, and the media is liberal. You know, that's been established by liberal studies. Yeah. News to them.
Like an Opus when they're reprogramming Bill the Cat. Seriously.
I'm enjoying this little joke I just thought of. I'm going to share with you.
Well, thank you.
The media and the university professors. I saw this at the university. As a knee-jerk response, they doubt everything. And of course, it's changing some now because of the chemical flavor, but they automatically doubt everything that our administration says and tend to believe everything the Russian government says.
Yeah.
And Reagan, the White House delivers a communique, it's immediately treated as a lie, unless there's concrete evidence to prove it's true. You know, you just watch a news conference.
Why is that?
Okay. Yet,
okay.
You notice
it. Yes,
and automatically, the liberal media automatically doubts it. And the university, I saw this. Liberal professors would automatically doubt anything Reagan said, the book back in my day was Carter as the president. They doubt everything Carter said. Then did the party.
Yeah.
and they automatically, their first response was whenever anything appeared to be a problem, they believed it. For instance, I sat in a symposium in which a Solzhenitsyn's name came up, and the assumption that everybody in there except me was, well, he's a liar. It's assumed that. Why? And the answer is this, that liberals believe the communists because they fundamentally believe in something. They believe in socialism. That is, they believe them because they believe in them. And they don't believe our government automatically because they don't believe in free enterprise. That's an oversimplified statement, but that's the heart of it. You understand? That is, if I believe in a system, I will tend to believe the purveyors of that system. But if I have a fundamental contempt for a system, I will automatically not believe the representatives of that system. And the reason that the university... Why is it that Castro... Who did Castro fool? Castro fooled Adlai Stevenson, the New York Times, and the vast majority of the university professionals. He said he's not a Marxist, and the New York Times hailed him as the George Washington of Cuba. You understand? I lived through this. And And yet, the evidence was clear he was a communist. He said he was a communist. It was in print that he was a communist. He had hobnobbed with the communists. He made no secret, not really. But the reason that the liberal media, the New York Times, right on down, that's the Bible. The New York Times is the Bible. The media, they teach, and everybody else says it's in there. They believed him because they wanted to believe him. And when he came out and said, when he got power, thanks to our support, he said, I'm a Marxist, always have been, always will be. And the New York Times said, my. How'd that happen? So this naivete, which is so frustrating to people like me, it was, how can you be? You've got to be a retarded chimpanzee to believe some of that stuff. And yet, here's my point is, those who believe in the system tend to believe the system. That makes sense to you? Joseph Sober says that they believe the communism because they believe in communism.
That works both ways.
Yes.
Logically with people. If you believe in the conservative American value system, you will
tend to believe.
No matter.
Yeah.
That's the way it works.
Can you just give us a real quick summary of how this filters down? I mean, liberal media is taught at liberal universities. Liberal professors teaching at liberal universities are taught by them.
By one of the liberal professors at Yale and Harvard and Chicago. Filters down. It filters down in for instance, the law, this generation of lawyers, attorneys have been taught by liberal lawyers. And so what happens is it's a cycle. It's a circle of it. And it's perpetuated. I'm not answering your question. It's filtered down in textbooks. It comes across the media. And by the way, if you want to, you've got to learn how to listen. It's not necessarily what they say, but how they say it, a choice of words, slang, if not anything, who they present, whether they use the word alleged or not. Is it supposed or alleged, or they use a quotation mark in the Bible? And you see it in their language. For instance, just last night, black South Africa, I heard the newscast of black Africans have been killed, something by the police, and on. But here's what they say. It says, this is how they word it. Whether it represents the truth or not, I don't know. But neither did the reporter. And say, what really exactly happened? Neither the reporter nor I knew, but we know. But here's how he worded it. Here's how he chose to word it. Here's how he chose to report it. Listen to this. He says, these three Africans have been killed by the police. The police reported that there was a riot, blah, blah, but they killed, the police attacked the demonstrators.
We don't know whether it was a riot or not.
It was a demonstration. It's one thing to shoot rioters, but it's something else to shoot demonstrators. But note this, here's how it worked. The police reported there was a riot. He shot the demonstrators. Now, what do you think about that? What, actually, if you believe, if you took the face value, was there a riot or was it or not a riot?
Sounds like there was because they want to demonstrate.
No, very clear, there was no riot. The police just lied about that. They called it a riot so they could shoot demonstrators. Yes, you see how they worded that? Great. That just happened last night. Now, of course, I'm going to shout on that because I lived in the 60s, maybe. There's no way you could become a rioter in the press. You could shoot down policemen, set fire to buildings, and they did, with people in them. You could blow up buildings with people in them, and you were a student demonstrator in the press, no matter what you did. You could be a person who had never been near a college classroom, or not been enrolled, has no plans to enroll. You could throw a firebomb at a National Guardsman, and you were, you and 500 others, and you were a student demonstrator. You go back and look at them. They would tell you, and there's really
humorous. You go back to the newspapers and shows these, you know, show these students throwing Molotov cocktails at campus police, and you know, and the demonstrators, you know, this group really passionate, the student demonstrate for, you know. That just really.
It's English language. That could be what the word demonstrator means.
But you,
it's not what people perceive.
See, well, demonstrator means you take a picket sign and you march and you chant. But when you and the comrade or another pick up the rocks and the firebombs and attack, set fire to buildings and kill people, you're not demonstrating anymore. But press, in fact, if you go back and look at the old press in the 60s, you will not find the word riot. They did not use it. It was for
the police started.
It was for police
action.
You understand that? So I'm conditioned now to when I hear demonstrator and that kind of, I'm maybe I'm pretty, you know. But that's an example of what you at the first sub, you know, not listening to the language, but it creates a pressure in people's minds inside. So I'm not saying it's not always accurate. I mean, I'm not saying it's always inaccurate when I report it that way. But when they just do it as a blanket policy, for instance, the word radical, you just watch the media and see where the word radical is and where it is not, where it always appears and where it never. Radical goes with the word fundamentalist.
Yeah.
It's a radical fundamentalist, but never a radical liberal. For instance, Jesse Jackson's views are just as radical as are Jerry Falwell's. The Falwell is always the radical. Jackson's never the radical. The radical is the negative majority. You just watch how that word is used. No matter, there's some people, no matter how patient you get, it is simply not the time. That word is never attached. And of course the press, I think I'm more interested in the press board than on the subject now. Get back on the side. A little bit, not all. We're seeing how this mind, once it sets itself to avoid evidence, it ends up all slandered and made in all kinds of ways. You cannot trust history. This generation knows absolutely nothing about the Kennedys of substance. Why? Because they were protected. They were preferred by the press. Now, the only reason that Nixon got impeached was that the press, he was out of the press. He did nothing that was unusual at all. Richard Nixon is the great evil man. You were raised to think that. That's simply not true. But was Nixon a louse? Yeah. But he was an average louse. Che Guevara, have you ever heard of him? I know Che Guevara. Who's this? That's the Cuban revolutionary. Who's this Latin, or Latin, the guy with Latin name, who's on 2020, the TV journalist?
Rivera.
Geraldo Rivera. Remember when Geraldo Rivera was on 2020, doing all these things? He quit 2020. You know why he quit? He prepared, see, while Jack Kennedy was in office, he was a great womanizer. He'd have these parties, he had orgies. He and Robert Kennedy both slept with Marilyn Monroe. And every other woman that came along, everybody knew it. And so was Lyndon Johnson, by the way. They had contests to see who could lay the most women in a week. And the other guy got ahead of him, they got jealous. And everybody knew it, the press corps knew it. Kennedy would have parties, invite these movie stars in, and in the afternoons they would go off the rooms. Anyway, and Jack Kennedy, while he was president, was sleeping with Marilyn Monroe, which that's a guy. And everybody knew it. The Washington Corps, press corps knew it, but it was not to be reported by. Suppose that Reagan did that. Do you think the press would say anything about it? Well, Geraldo Rivera, who's not a conservative, he documented this, the Jack Kennedy and the relationship between Bobby Kennedy and Jack Kennedy and and documented, any question. It all documented, and he got ready to show it, and the network wouldn't show it. And so he was not in protest. Because to Westmoreland City. So they pick and choose. It's interesting. Do you notice how that was amazing? I love Time Magazine. When I might have worked with this one, the other candidate, Senator Ted Kennedy. Remember he got drunk, he drowned in the river, and they had one of his girlfriends with him. And he got drunk and went off a bridge and drowned him, poor thing. He got out, and he was too drunk to save her, so she drowned. What was her name?
Marianne
Peckham at Chappaquiddick. 8 hours later, he shows up at the police station to report it. 8 hours. Which is the time it takes to sober up. What he did was he swam out and took him back to the house and they sobered him up. They got him sober, then they went down and reported it. So he got a dead girl, and a dead girlfriend. And he said, why did he not report it earlier? Well, he got confused. The newspapers, oh yeah, I confused all of that then, and that was the gospel. And Ted Kennedy, the papers, they tell about the light. Go back and read it. The OR, tell about the light touch. I mean, they were sympathetic, poor guy. It's an accident, and because of the accident, he got confused. And it took him 8 hours to figure out how to call somebody. Well, you know, that could happen to anybody. That is the precious thing. It could happen to anybody. See, and now Ted Kennedy's talking about running for president again. He said, he's got to be manslaughter, nothing else. He belongs in prison. And not that White House. It's amazing. It's astounding to see body and certain ones. Why? Why do they believe everything Ted Kennedy says? Because they believe in socialism. They believe in this. You understand? They believe in his philosophy. They believe it all. It's just automatic. So everything that Reagan says is automatically a lie. Everything Ted Kennedy says is automatically true. Ted Kennedy is going to trivialize the idea of calling it Star Wars. He trivialized it. And another example is, remember when the late vice president of the Democratic candidate, Jordan Guerrero, when they established a gangster, that her husband had gangster deals, had not reported all of her income. She said, oh my goodness, no, it's just an oversight. Those shops don't mind. And the Time magazine said, yeah, we spotted her, didn't she say? And then they bought her story and dropped it the next day. It was like amazing. Which is what they would have done for Ray.
Sure.
And of course, the thing they never told about the Kennedys was the Kennedys were a gangster family. Old Joe Kennedy.
His money
was a part of the underworld. So he got the Kennedy fortune is underworld money. This is one of the most amazing things in history. Yeah, Bobby Kennedy is regarded as a great one of the martyrs. It's a good thing they shot Jack Kennedy because he had lived and carried out his programs so that they'd shown the failures they were. Yes.
I'm really in the dark when it comes to you're talking about Kennedy's belief in the social system.
Socialism.
Socialism. Say you would, get selected for president. What would the difference be between what Reagan is doing now and what he's doing as far as believing in socialism?
Well, it'd be all kinds of things. For instance, he would cut the defense budgets and he'd cut the defense budget in half and double the welfare.
Do you really think Kennedy's going to get that?
No.
Very
few people aren't going to. Yes.
Something that I brought to mind when we're talking about Catholic
Church.
Most of the people I know don't press to make further than they'd be taking. Simply because of that, and that causes me to wonder how much credence people give to the newspapers.
Well, it's interesting what's happening. The newspapers are trying to, they're pinning up their act. Not as bad as it used to be. In the 60s and 70s, it was terrible. What's happened is that they've got so bad, they were so flagrant for so long, they begin to study the fact that the American people don't believe. That's, by the way, that's one of the most interesting things, that Reagan got elected. See, the Reagan, according to the media, did not exist. And they despised him. They hated him. You were those press guys trying to set him up. They made him. The press hates Reagan. And it's interesting. It was, I think the most interesting thing happened is that the power, you remember the first election, the full power of the media was leveled against Reagan. No holds barred. Everything, they pulled out all the stops, and he got elected anyway. And boy, you talk about sobering. Well, that was a sobering experience, which you have to be. Like they in their mind, he was dead. And he'd been why? Because people just, so I think it's a little reaction set in.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, we don't know. Well, the point is, he got so blamed. This thing, in other words, when people, for instance, who saw what the press did to Nixon, and I'm not saying Nixon should have been impeached. I mean, should have resigned. He should have. I'm not sanctioning what he did. I mean, but what he did was no worse than what anybody else did. That idea about the hypocrisy. But there was a bumper sticker out during Watergate. The bumper sticker said, nobody died at Watergate. They were referring to Chappelle. Here's Ted Kennedy, when he was so self-righteous, he held a press conference every other day, and last Nixon, Watergate. Here, he should have been in prison for the manslaughter, at least. And people, that kind of thing. Well, let's get back to our point. This is all instructive on the grass, a little bit oblique. But my point is, you see this in political science, in philosophy, and in scientism. You also see it in theology. But my point is that the amazing thing is astounding that the enlightened view of man prevails despite decades and decades of evidence. You have to wonder. Let me give you an example. Here is this. People believe if they believe in the good, they believe in them. The Sentinel Star, for instance, the editor of the Sentinel Star, thinks that we should make an agreement with Russia. We should take their word for it. They would keep their side of any kind of nuclear arms deal. The fact that you get people on the I stand in the room. Stay in the room. You thought we should just sign the treaty. Take each other's word for it. I mean, that's the ultimate of naivete. But why? Because they believe in the system. If they be a fundamental belief in the system, or in that view, any different view, to believe it. And you see, by the way, this is cultism. People believe that the people have died in Jonestown. They believe they're good at everything Jones said. Why can't they believe in him? Oral Roberts gets well beyond that. People believe everything he said. He sees 900 that Jesus applied. They believe what he says, but they believe in him. So, it's really some different thing in consideration. Okay, we come down to evolution of the cultural myth. A cultural myth are explanations of life and its origins. Cultural myths so coincide with the contemporary spirit that their often radical contradiction and absurdities are never apparent. That's a very important statement. Cultural myths, and evolution is a cultural myth, so coincide with the contemporary spirit. Does evolution fit the contemporary spirit? Certainly it does. That their often radical contradictions and absurdities are never apparent. They express the basic presuppositions of everyday life and thought. This is the phenomenon of the human mind. Evolution is absurd, yet it is. This is why Malcolm Muggeridge says that future historians are going to laugh at us for believing it. But it seems very respectable now. You see, whether evolution is true or false, what you must understand, there is no necessary connection between what everybody believes and what is true. The fact that people have certain attitudes, cultural attitudes. In no way, should be taken as evidence that those attitudes are rational. It's one of the reasons why, by the way, this is true in religion,
perfect while we're getting off the subject. You might get y'all getting off the subject, so I'm getting some of it.
This is certainly true in theology. This is one of the reasons why I insist over and over and over and over that the Bible is our standard of orthodoxy, not human, not anecdotal human testimony, not human experience. Why? Because you see, there are cultural myths in the field of theology too. The Christianity, the church, that's a cultural myth, which have no connection with anything. Things can be broadly believed, widely accepted, assumed as being true, which can be very often incorrect. But don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that everything that is assumed by a culture is false. Most things that cultures believe in are true. But what I'm saying is that this isn't philosophy, you don't go that far, this is simply history, that broadly held ideas often are irrational. Therefore, the fact that, you know, when I was on my TV in a discussion with the head of the ACLU, he kept pulling numbers on me. And look how many people are in illusion, look how many signs of revolution. And I had to say to him, look, you don't tell me shoot that many heads. Matter of fact, you count in certain areas, you count heads, you probably the fact that everybody believes it, probably makes it suspect in certain kinds of things. Not the other way around. For instance, I'll give you an example. This shows the capacity for the modern mind to be irrational. If there was a germ, a bacteria going around, with me, a bacteria going around that did one tenth of the physical damage, including death, but not just death, understand? My physical damage, I include death. There was a bacteria going around which did one tenth the physical damage to man that liquor, alcohol does. Our nation and the health services would mount cancer would fade into the background, national defense would fade, all the national resources of the nation would immediately go to be eradicated, to get rid of it once and for all. Instead, something which is 10 times worse, what we do, well, we have government stores that license, government farmers get licensed to sell it. But why? Well, alcoholism is a disease. That's a cultural myth, by the way. Alcoholism is not a disease. But it is a disease. Some disease you go out and buy. it's licensed, and supposed to have a cancer store if you can go and get cancer. Well, yeah, and my baby, and drink, if you drink something, it gives you cancer. But look, it does give you cancer. But it tastes good. Somebody said, I know you get cancer, but it tastes good. Don't die from it right away. Like, it may take 10 years to get it. You know, it's your name, cigarettes. See what I'm saying? Just irrational. Well, but it's that alcoholism is a disease, and we advertise it. See what I'm saying? The role it plays in American life. It's a part of growing up. How do you say that? Well, you know, you're not really a man if you got polio. What are you laughing about? That makes just as much sense as saying you're not a man because you drink alcohol. Isn't it? Polio is what you say, multiple sclerosis. You're not a man, so you got multiple sclerosis. When you get MS, you've arrived, baby. You've come a long way, baby. Why? That's hurt. Dude, you put it that way, it's just, everybody laughs. It's just stupid. But it makes equal sense. You know what I'm saying? I'm just illustrating to you the fact that we must never be stampeded by cultural myths. That's my point. That's what I'm trying to enforce and to impress upon your minds. You got that? Never be stampeded by cultural myths, including evolution. Cultural myth. Now, listen, some cultural myths are true. They're based on fact. They just have a myth. We just stop using myth. Some cultural myths are very true. For instance, it's a cultural myth that you ought not to eat too much red meat, not eat your veggies. Everybody knows that. We don't do it, but we know that. It's a cultural myth that you ought not to smoke a cigar when you're filling your gas tank. Unless you get launched. there's sort of cultural, ideas everybody has, which are okay. They express the basic presuppositions in everyday life, which may or may not be true. The fundamental assumption of the modern era is autonomous nature, self-existence, self-ruling, Mother Nature. Nature does. I've said this a number of times. And by the way, it got so bad they quit doing it pretty much now. But the idea of the prophets, where they take God out, put the word nature in, which is absurd. Nature designs, nature is frivolous here, nature experiments. All this kind of language is used. The worst of all is the guy who wrote the territorial imperative, John Audrey. He wrote the territorial imperative.
What about man?
Here he has nature getting frivolous, nature gets daring. I mean, come off it. I mean, as I told my professor at the university, I said, "Have you noticed, Dr. Jensen, how these fellows will dismiss God as a myth and use nature as a metaphor?" And that metaphor is everything our man does. Interesting. And I noticed in later textbooks that the word nature is not appearing as much. I'm getting embarrassed by all of that. I'm going to get young in it. Nature perceived the need for fill in the blank. And you want to go, "Old saw my leg off." Or, "Oh, get off my poor tired back." Autonomous nature, the fundamental motive is moral freedom. That's a very important statement. The fundamental assumption of the modern era is autonomous nature. That's how evolution fits in. The fundamental motive is moral freedom. Listen to me. The reason, I'm going to teach you this. You don't know this already. This is time. We're coming into the course. We're tying things together. This is the history and logic of science. This is one of the most important statements I could ever make in teaching the history and logic of science. Evolution would be thrown out tomorrow on a scientific basis if it were not that evolution furnishes what seems to be the philosophical basis for moral freedom. As long as the theory of evolution offers what seems to be an intellectually respectable foundation for moral freedom, it will persist no matter what the evidence or lack of it. It's good. See, if we're just going to stand or fall scientifically, it'll fall a long time ago. And it's crumbling. The body is thing, using Dean Chambers' metaphor. But they cannot bury it. Why? Moral freedom. And the only reason. I want to do what I want to do. Better a world without meaning than a world under divine control and judgment. Better, that's the moral, that's the current, that's a part of the cultural myth. Better a world without meaning than a world under divine control and judgment. Better a meaningless existence than one under control. Why? I want to be God. You got that? Here's what the modern man says. I would rather be the God of a meaningless world than to be a servant in a world of order and beauty that promised for eternity. I'm going to be God.
Ruin
hell and serve. Pardon? Ruin hell and serve. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, the old man. Ruin hell and serve. That's me. Evolution grants man a seemingly adequate power of creation with none of the requirements imposed by the God of the Bible, a concept of creation that permits man to take total control of natural order. list here some of the promised blessings. Here we go over to ethics again. The promised blessings of the scientific utopia. The computerized workless society, about which I've said. Scientific, egalitarian. What's egalitarian mean? It means equal. The doctrine of equality. Everybody's equal. Women and men are equal. Rich and poor are equal. Old and young are equal. All races are equal. Equality of pay, equality of opportunity, equality of everything. What's the problem with that? All men, does the Constitution say all men are equal? It means equal before the law. The problem with egalitarianism, the old saying is the problem with egalitarianism, all men are not equal. And the only way to make men equal is still, remember the Greek Draco was walking, was the, not the Greek, was it? Yeah. Was it Draco? Yeah, it was Draco.
One of the democratic, one
of the democratic dictators of Greece walked the field. I can see the middle of the center. About equal, unless they have, he was taking his sword and walking off the highest kids. Egalitarian. Very deadly thing. Egalitarian society. Who did Paul want to kill? Before being educated, spiritual, and married. Did I have education? Paul Pot. Communist did. China. And now our mayor's attitude to that. Christians don't really censor Frederick for having tea with communists because that's the same house, the same government. It's put to death thousands and thousands of Christians in worship places. It's mind-boggling. Egalitarian, international, there's one world government. Internationalism is a part of the evolution. Been written into it, but it doesn't even make sense. There's no necessary connection, but internationalism. Textbooks teach internationalism. This is one of the things my big gripes about the humanist. This is part of the humanist agenda. People ask, what is humanism? This is one aspect of humanism. Well, who can say what humanism is? I know what it is. I'll tell you. Evolutionism, moral relativism, internationalism, atheism. That's humanism. What's a secular humanist? Who can say what a secular humanist is? You know what I'm saying? Atheism, evolutionism, moral relativism, internationalism. That's secular humanism. What's internationalism? The idea that we're going to evolve properly. We must do away with different nations. We must have one world government, one nation, one constitution. That is the humanist agenda, you're saying? Be the humanist manifesto. Okay, let's take our question. And you deal with this in the ethics class.
It's all the time I'm ever going to like do your class.
I'm going to let you up with my Darwin heads up. Well, here are some of the things that we can talk about at great length. We don't have time. The creation of life, oh yeah. Or the prolongment of life, not long. Physical modification, some of us can stand it. Mental modification, all of you can stand it. Fertility control. A woman can't have children. A lot of work is being done in that area. Abortion. Control of sexual desire. They're trying to get people who are rapists for the shot. Artificial insemination. We've been doing it on cattle for years, now we're doing it on people. Sex control in births. Make sure you want a boy, make sure you're a boy. Or a girl. artificial inoculation, artificial placentas, cloning, which is parthenogenesis, means virgin, regenerated body parts, like a lizard, tail, eugenics, it's control of the brain, electrical control of the brain, chemical control of behavior, memory, intelligence, and freezing techniques, you know, when somebody dies, that's where they die, freeze them, so they're curious enough where they're dying at, you can fall out, so cure it.
He's not frozen wide. He's not frozen dead.
Frozen dead.
Did he embalm it? Is it dead?
I don't know.
Sure, where he may get to. Oh, it's like a regular body. Yeah.
Unless,
like,
he's dead. I'm just wondering, you know, there's high school kids that got frozen up in Oregon about years ago. They found some of those frozen and they're like thawing them out and monitoring them and see if they come back to life.
Well, that's hypothermia. That's different.
So that's possible.
They didn't freeze too dead. They weren't dead. After a person dies, they freeze the body in hopes that the technology 100 years from now.
Yeah.
Okay. You read about this man recently who had liver disease since he wouldn't have a wife, pregnant his wife. Now the fetus grown and aborted, so they can transplant his child's fetus, kidney, or liver to him. We're doing this now, of course, using babies for spare parts. Well, you see, all of this is very... Some of these things are... These are not equal, you know what I'm saying? I'm not saying all these are unethical. These are things that ethics has to deal with. It's called bioengineering. That's the rubric, that's the overarching term, bioengineering. That's part of it. Control of nature is one of the promised blessings of the scientific utopia. Total scientific agriculture, control of weather, factory produced food, grown, and the colonization of the universe, the exploitation of space, which we're talking about. The mind of moon and night, I mean, is that far off? Pardon? I don't think that mind of moon. I don't think that mind of moon is going to get any. Okay. Any question on what we talk about? This is the mythology of modern science. And certainly Christianity stands in antithesis, not to science, but to scientism, as we said a number of times. And I think we as Christians would find modern mythology of science very credible. Man become God. Science was used to make man God. Well, man, I'll tell you, the thing I fear about this, speaking in the most general terms, is that man has never been a very good God. His wife wants a job. He always boxes us. You see, the debate between modern secularism and Christianity is not in the area of science. It's not the science part, it's the philosophy part. Okay, now we come to. I want to. We have two more hours to meet up. I'll get through this. Here's a book I think you ought to know about. You familiar with this?
So it's cracking out years ago. Copyright years ago.
You've seen the hardback version.
I've got the paperback.
You get the paperback. So it's a very important book. I recommend you get it. It's put out by the Philosophical Library, which is not a creationist publishing house, New York. It's got three authors, Charles Thaxton, Walter Bradley, and Roger Olson. It's in the library in hardback. Or out of the library in that name. I don't know if it's cataloged yet. Last time I saw it, it wasn't cataloged. I forgot my name.
Yeah, she gave it to me.
Well, that's right, I got that. I get that from you.
Yeah. Oh, so you got books, you don't know, I'm sure I get back. You got some. You don't have
any. Oh, no.
You got some. Another lesson. Anyway, when we talk about evolution, we talked about the current revolt which is going on, that evolutions are bailing out and becoming creationists. Well, that's true of this book. These three authors. I'll tell you who they are. Charles B. Faxon, Director of the Curriculum Research at the Foundation for Fallen Ethics in Dallas, Texas. Walter R. Bradley is a professor of mechanical engineering at Texas A&M University. Roger Olson is the project geochemist for the Diapolonia Waste Management Services in Inglewood, California, as a geochemist. This is what's being said about the book. Robert Jastrow, he's the guy who wrote God and Astronomers. He's the founder and former director of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies at NASA. He says, a valuable summary of evidence against the chemical evolution of life. So it's about chemical evolution. Out of non-living matter here. It presents a well-thought-out and intelligent analysis of the alternatives to the accepted theory of the origin of life. Robert Shapiro, professor of chemistry at New York University, writes, complimentary to Dean Kenyon, professor of biology at San Francisco State University, writes, arguments are cogent, original, and compelling. The authors, I believe, and I now concur, there's a fundamental flaw in all current theories of chemical origins of life. There's a fundamental flaw. So the book is well received, as it is.
What kind of conclusions are those he drawing?
Listen, like, it's crazy. Okay, and who wrote the epilogue? Listen to this. You can't touch him, it's also the epilogue. It's just it's three authors that work together on it. It doesn't say who wrote it. It says this. To be sure, not everyone who goes into the matter will reach the creationist conclusion that we have. The authors are not to argue for creationists. Look what I say at the bottom of your page. The above discussion is not a simple quote, it is not meant as a scientific proof of a creator. It doesn't mean that. It is merely a line of reason to show the special creation by a creator beyond the cosmos as a possibility of the origin of science. Now, so here's the reason this book is, what I'm trying to teach you is this. The reason this book is important is because it represents, it's an excellent book. Talk about the arguments. You want to deal with chemical evolution, it is the last word, not him. In a concise way, you can't do a better expression. Very well done. If you want to really, good grasp, good handle on the arguments, both ways. So you get what he does. What they do is just line up the arguments for chemical evolution and then just analyze them. Everyone's documented. The reason that this book is important is not only because of its character, it represents this new wave. You see, creationists are on the new wave. Well, the old wave come back around again. And this book represents that. Now, and what I've done for you to help give you an example of, we're studying the mythology of science. This is a sort of an addendum, somewhat of a study of the mythology of science. This copy belongs to Pluto. Let me give it to him. See how I can get it. Let me go over this with you. Okay. This is what I've given you is an outline based on. This is not a complete outline. Get the book. I tell you some liberties. It's an outline based on the epilogue. He doesn't even mention creation in his view except in the epilogue, which is the an outline based on the epilogue of Faxon, Bradley and Olson, I gave you the title. If you want to buy the part of the book, there's the bibliographic information on it. Now, the book itself, the reason I really want to acquaint you with this book, or I should have urged you, if I'm going to sign the book, so I can't urge you to do the book. You don't have to lumber it. You got it. Do you agree? You didn't just read it to me?
This part is not. Yeah.
A lot of it's technical. Anyway, let me, now this, so this is an outline, not of the epilogue, you understand? It's an outline based on the epilogue, or is it, it's an outline of parts of the epilogue. But I think you'd like, I thought you might like to have this in sort of controllable form, so I want to give it to you, I'm going to give it to you now. This is probably interesting today, probably. The introduction, he has, in the book, he shows the fundamental implausibility that unassisted matter and energy organize themselves into living systems. That's the gist of the book here. He demonstrates that view is implausible. It will not work. And he gives all his reasons why. Now, those arguments, now that is not a contribution. In the sense that he's not saying anything that's not been said before. It's interesting how, like in the case of Hoyle and others, they all of a sudden, one of the creationists have been saying for a long time, as I said before, and the cuckoo, all of a sudden now all of a sudden they become respectful. It's invaluable that Luke makes a contribution in that area, and that it updates it and summarizes that contribution. The basic arguments, the thing. Basically playing out all along in creation science. Again, remember, chemical evolution is what the book is about. It's about the mystery of life's origin, reassessing current theories. So it's not dated in value. He lists here the alternatives to popular textbook prebiogenesis. That's my phraseology, not his. And here are the alternatives. If you do not accept textbook prebiogenesis, Miller Urey, Fox, and that kind of thing. What do you have left? We list the five alternatives. These would overlap some. First of all, he lists new natural laws. By the way, as he says, this is what people are offering. This is not simply theoretically. He's not saying theoretically there are these five alternatives. He's saying that, and it's true, that actually people, you can buy both books, textbooks even, for the newer textbooks, which offer one or more or some combination of these views. New natural laws. This is, those of you who took logic, what is the argument ad futuris? View of the future. That, and I've already pointed out that evolutionists do this regularly. It's a logical fallacy. It's a fallacy of informal logic. Remember when I talked to him, I said, give you an illustration of how did I get convicted? The prosecuting attorney says, I don't have any evidence, but you go ahead and put the man to death for the murder, you're convinced that the next month or so we're going to find him. Here for the future. Well, what many are saying is, we know that it happened, but we cannot explain it in terms of known natural laws, but in the future we are trusting that new natural laws will be discovered, which will make it all clear.
What is the
fallacy? On futuris. To the appeal of the future. Well, the problem with this is, not only is this bad logic, bad on bad forensics, it is bad. That's bad science because new natural laws are not going to contradict known natural laws. Second is panspermia. You know that is the idea, the basic idea that life is being that the information for configuration or entropy or the the information necessary to form. Produce the genetic information to provide higher and higher quality of life. That is when the animal is fed. The earth is being seeded. The photo is spermium. The earth is being seeded. So the life did not begin here, it began somewhere else. The earth is being seeded with life. So life came. Life did not appear when the chemicals shuffled around and interacted and got themselves together to life. But life was introduced to the earth, whether it was seen from space.
So that article is understated, so that just one person said, I mean, Lord, your life is my whole business to be a spacecraft.
Well, that's directed pan. That's the next one. Directed panspermia is the idea that, and we've already talked about these, I'm just summarizing, you know, I don't have to go into the weaknesses of these, but the basic weakness is this doesn't answer the origin, this relocates it. The idea of directed panspermia is the idea that that the earth has been seeded from without, but it's been done in a directed way, not a random way, and that your spacecraft. Well, direct, that's panspermia. Direct means that there's been a conscious effort.
Okay.
That's what the word direct means. Yes. That is, that sometime in the eons in the past, a spaceship visited Earth, and a little green man, whatever they did, what color they were, I don't know what color now, planted life and went back, and come back soon. And then somebody said he's flying saucer and went back, checking how they're doing. Then there is the view of special creation by a creator within the cosmos. That is Hoyle and Wickersham. Hoyle says that there is a creator within the cosmos, not the God of the Bible, but a creator within the cosmos who created life, and so and a higher level of information exists out there. And that's why you see here. It's a version of panspermia, understand? Panspermia overlaps with this. It's a panspermia.
It's still
a view. That's good. Yes.
So it's still a pulsar.
Go ahead.
Good one. So, the creator within the cosmos, he's a part of nature.
Yes. He's the creator within the cosmos is to be identified with the cosmos. And here, Hoyle and others, Paul's the most famous one, who appeals to a Hindu kind of concept. That's why I said I think Hoyle would be the guru of the new age of the gurus.
But it is considered to be something natural,
supernatural
creation. Is this supernatural within the cosmos or natural within the cosmos?
What they would say is that what I think Hoyle would say, though I haven't read it, would have to say that this that line is an arbitrary line between supernatural and natural.
Didn't the same be said of God?
Someone said that. I think it can't be said because of mine.
So Hoyle's creator within the cosmos and his panspermia, it should be a random panspermia.
No.
So still, this is somewhat of a direct.
No, this is direct panspermia by a special creator. Now, what this is the difference here. Panspermia says that, this straight panspermia says that life just exists with no explanation given, and Earth is being seeded with it. Directed panspermia says there's an intelligent life out there that's directly in the seeding of the earth, but again, with no explanation given of the source. This goes one step further and says that there's a God, quote, small g, implicit in the universe. There's a deity of sorts, at least, implicit in the universe, which is directly in the panspermia. So as you go from this unexplained, random, natural panspermia to direct the panspermia by a spaceman, space traveler, to a impersonal, implicit deity, unexplainable, that is directed.
That seems to have a lot of trouble with this pantheism.
Oh, yeah, it's very pantheistic. It is pantheistic. Plus, it's a very interesting concept.
Well, I'm just having trouble with it's hard for me to figure out exactly what it means.
That's because you're not a Hindu. I'm having the same trouble.
Because, you know, I wonder, does his creator have an origin, or is he...
No, it's impersonal. But the God is not the God of the Bible. It's that deity somehow, in that sense, it is implicit in the universe, intrinsic to it.
So it's a part of the nature of what it is, or
yes, but even not your nature of the old sense. It makes sense to your trouble, like Christian Science.
I'm not trying to make sense of it, I'm trying to make sense of his thing.
Yeah, I mean, you're trying to understand what he's saying. It's hard to nail down. I've done the best I can. So, although, I didn't realize until I read this book exactly, because he cites other writings of what Hoyle doesn't, in his book, The Intelligent Universe, doesn't. He doesn't go further. He doesn't try to identify this intelligence. In other writers, he does. And Bradley Paxton and Olson cite that. And do you know what it is? What they say is that. They say, have you noticed that man has never been able to exterminate a single species of insect? Hoyle thinks that it's very likely, that this higher intelligence is insects, and that they just haven't made it known yet because everything's going according to plan.
So what are they going to do to us?
That's what Hoyle says.
Look what we've been doing.
That's weird, isn't it?
Look what we've been doing in the first time.
I killed a roach. I sprayed my house last week, and I didn't find them. I found three dead water bugs. Are they going to call me for judgment? That's what he says. These scientists think I make for it. I couldn't believe when I read this.
The movie goes out not too long ago. None of this documentary. If the insect decided to take over, there's not a thing we can do about it. If there was possible. And that might go in. That's where it goes.
Here it is.
Well,
Harlan Wickram Singh. He's a Hindu. So that Oriental influence. Speculate further, speculate, I'm reading now, page 199. See, I've never read any other works of Hoyle, so this was news to me. We come now to what for us is a strong argument for the existence of an overt plan of planetary invasion. We have so far been unable to exterminate a single insect species, or even one species among millions. And then the authors say, and what we learn from this various fact, and we go back to quoting Hoyle. The situation points clearly to one of two possibilities. Either we are dealing with an overt plane invented by an intelligence considerably higher than our own, or the insects have already experienced selection pressure against intelligences at least our level and many other environments elsewhere in the universe. And as the reason, the insects, either the insects represent that intelligence, or they are beyond us because they are more durable than we are.
What about sharks or any other thing you want to say?
What does that tell us? What tells us how far a guy will go to avoid God, to avoid Genesis? You might talk about science fiction, modern science fiction. This is Fred Hoyle. I mean, this isn't, you know, he didn't just fall on the turn, but
sounds like it.
It shows how far men will go to avoid Genesis.
Why? You see, well, you've got to answer to it, but you don't have to answer to it. Moral judgment. And roaches and bugs or bees don't impose moral judgment, but God does. So we'll avoid them at all. That's what we do. No, I don't know. I tell you, remember I said, well, I didn't say that, but one of my sayings is that it's probably an evolution thing. I'm an evolution. I'm going to bridge the book in my life. I'll make a price on it. Well, it's not a book in the past. You got that? I mean, you believe in evolution? You believe in that? That's hard, but that really is. You didn't know that, did you?
No, it is.
But it's the bugs. Beat me up, Scotty. So that really, I guess that means that if I kill a tick, then I'm assaulting a higher intelligence. I've been teaching my country for a few years now.
Number four. Why is creation a bad word?
Well, he gives three reasons. First of all, he's speaking as scientists. Creation involves the supernatural. And what does a scientist have to do with the supernatural? Nothing. That's one of the first things we discussed in this quote. So that, and scientists are like men, scientists do not want to be left out of anything. Like all men. And therefore, there is this bias. Modern scientists, as I've documented, and talked about it about knowledge perhaps, modern scientism has a bias against the supernatural. Well, if you start talking about the bugs, and intelligence, and birds, and bugs, and insects, that's a bias.
Well, earlier, it makes matter pops out of nowhere anyway.
Yeah, it's a clear bias against it. Secondly, and I've said enough about that, creation entails discontinuity. That is, you cannot trace the physical world back infinitely in a chain of cause and effect. This effect is an effect of that cause, all the way back to whatever. The majority of scientists, and let the word he uses, and I emphasize, and I capitalize it, prefer continuity. What's wrong with that? What's the significance of prefer? He italicizes it. The majority of scientists prefer continuity. It's subjective, right? That's the right question. It's subjective. Scientists also prefer science as a methodology as opposed to studying the facts with no preference on how it's supposed to come out. You study evidence, you perform an experiment, it might produce A, it might produce B. The scientist does not hope that it produces one or the other. And he not now, listen, that the scientist as a man can hope one thing or the other, but as a science, there can be no preference. It's pure, but the facts speak for themselves, the chips fall where they may. But science, creation, majority of scientists prefer continuity. Now, that is, a part of continuity is utter predictability. On this basis, they don't like miracles. That is, the question is like this. You say, well, why does the tree grow? Well, the scientist wants to say the tree grows because the seed was planted and nutrients were in the soil and there's many generations there and there's a tree. And they don't want to allow God in at any point, or the supernatural at any point, continuity, all the way back to the beginning. But that's bias. The quantum revolution has banished the notion of continuity as a necessity in science. Remember, I taught you about quantum physics, that predictability is not there the way it was always assumed. Newtonian physics, the theme of Newtonian AP of Newtonian physics was predictability for quantum physics is there. The point he makes here, as he saw as a scientist, is that continuity. You can be a secularist or an evolutionist, but you can't have continuity anyway. Because the quantum physics has ruled out continuity as a necessity. Here, as a necessity in scientific enterprise.
That's totally true.
Theoretically, what do you mean? It's theoretically true.
There's still an awful lot of that. The randomness that they found there doesn't
negate continuity. Yes, but you see the point that they're not sure why. There is more continuity than quantum physics would lead us to expect. And in the light of that, what he's saying is that often creationism is ruled out because they want continuity, they don't have anybody. Not theoretically, it's not if you accept quantum physics. Now we as Christians would say, wait a minute, there is continuity. But we're saying there is continuity in the universe. Observable continuity. And it certainly is.
So the continuity that they prefer actually is is a it would be something that would point more towards creation and to if quantum physics is true, it's more a proof for creation than it would be for.
Well, no, he's not saying that's going that far. What he's saying is that scientists, most scientists, want an ultimate continuity so that there'd be utter predictability. What he's saying is that on that basis they rule out creation by a period without, but they rule out creationism, many of them. But he's, what he's saying is that, but that is not, that, that is, that, not, that does not rule out creationism, and even if you're not a creationist, the concept of continuity as a necessity has been ruled out by quantum physics.
That's what I'm saying. So continuity has been completely ruled out. I got the impression from what you're saying that quantum physics completely ruled out continuity.
No,
ruled out as a necessity.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
Because the molecular activity subatomic activity is, as I diagram on the board, it is not as predictable as was thought.
Yeah.
The number of possibilities are infinite, whereas before they were thought to be singular. I remember I diagrammed on the board.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's a very abstract concept. Simply to say that utter continuity is undermined. Theoretic ultimate continuity, and utter continuity, which is what ultimate word I'm using, by quantum physics anyway. That is, as I said before, I'm repeating myself, there's more continuity than could be expected by a purely naturalistic view. Quantum physics opens the door to creationism, doesn't prove it, opens the door to it, and creates a problem. Quantum physics, then, opens the door to creationism, theoretically, and creates all kinds of problems for, say, chemical evolution.
Yeah, I understand that. I don't understand the statement.
Okay. He's saying that the quantum revolution has banished the notion of continuity as a necessity in science. That is, he's saying that traditionally, many scientists have excluded creation because they say if you have creation, you have a discontinuity introduced into the order of things. But he says quantum physics has already introduced, at least theoretically, discontinuity into the order of things. But, so his point is, many scientists object to creationism, saying, well, if you've got creation, you've got discontinuity. And he's saying that.
Okay, I understand that statement. That didn't appear to me to be saying the same thing as what's said here, though.
Well, look at it, and maybe I'm seeing something you don't see, or you're seeing something I don't see.
I think the quantum physics banishes the notion of continuity as a necessity, since that the subatomic level, there's no continuity. But everything that we see is...
There's continuity, but there's no perceived basis for continuity, is what you're right. There's no perceived basis for continuity.
But everything's composed of these things that seemingly don't have any continuity.
Right.
But yet, it says that there's continuity now, or overall composed of it has
continuity. So what you're saying is that continuity cannot be used as an argument against creation. That's quantum physics.
But what I'm saying is, just because in one area you see now there's some randomness,
yeah,
that doesn't completely vanish the necessity of continuity, because we see it in so many other areas of in science.
Yes.
See what I'm saying?
Yes.
I don't think the statement's right. I just disagree with the statement.
Well, what he's saying, he's not saying there's no observable continuity in nature. He's saying that continuity cannot be used as an argument against creationism.
Okay, yeah, and I can understand that.
And that's what the statement means, whether he says it or not. That's what he means by the statement.
If scientists refer
exempted from grace. That's salvation or any of that causality. If he does what now?
If he prefers continuity in a sense,
yeah,
would he be forced to accept an infinite regress?
No. I think all of us are saying they do accept it.
But they can't depend on it.
Well, you can feed them on that ground. Usually they want to hold it.
But this is what he's talking about, those things that concern science about creation. That's what he's talking about. Number one, involves the supernatural, trying to make that concern. Secondly, it involves discontinuity and that concern. Third, what will come to you next time you begin with? See, creation might be sort of a scientific question about it. Those are three names. He's saying this is why scientists have this bias against creation.
Thank you.